For this and all clinical updates podcasts, a 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit will be available for a limited time. To claim credit, view the slide deck associated with this podcast and complete the evaluation found in the slides. Speakers, planners, and CME staff do not have any relevant financial relationships with ineligible companies to disclose.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Clinical Podcast. Today, we have Angela Berriel, who works in wound care at CentraCare, Wilmar Rice Hospital. Hi, Angie. Thank you for joining me.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Of course. We are going to be talking about venous stasis and wound care, something we both deal with. So let's get right into it. Why does venous stasis happen? Well, what is it?
So it happens when you get valves that are not working in the lower extremities, usually from hypertension in the veins. And it can happen either as a primary cause, which can be hereditary, or a secondary cause, such as from like DVTs or trauma, where there's scar tissue that actually damages that vein. And so, yeah, those veins just don't work anymore. They start to leak and it causes increased pressure on the vein wall.
Okay. Now, I want to stop right there when you say hereditary. Do you see sometimes this really interesting family history that people will tell you, or is a rarity to get a clear family history of my mom or dad had it, my sister or brother?
Yeah,
had it?
Usually it's just that they've, you know, those mainly parents or siblings that have had issues with it have had to have interventions such as sclerotherapy or ablations, or that a lot of people talk about, you know, the venous stripping, which we don't do as much anymore. But
yeah,
usually that's where we hear about it.
Okay. Now, the bulk of the patients that I see in you know, because I have wounds, aware the wound is infected, cellulitis, and so on, all I can find is obesity. But if I ask you to rank the risk factors that you commonly seen or what's in the literature, how would you rank them for secondary, right? People without strong family history.
Sure. So yeah, like you said, obesity is huge. So really talking with them about weight management, pregnancies, if they've had multiple pregnancies, that definitely will increase it. And then if they have a job where they stand on their feet in one place for long periods of time throughout the day, or vice versa, they're sitting for long periods of time throughout the day, that definitely can be another one of those risk factors for it. So,
okay. Natural history of it. Is there a symptom that, you know, sometimes what happens in the clinic is a patient tells you something, you look, you don't see anything, and say, well, I don't see anything. Is there a symptom that people should pay attention? The patient is mentioning something, I don't see anything, but perhaps is early manifestation.
You know, that achiness, that they, if they complain of that persistent achiness and heaviness in their legs, that definitely is kind of one of those things that you think, okay. And even the burning and tingling that can go along with it, and cramping. If they have cramping in those legs, that can also be another big red flag for it. But usually you'll have visual signs to go along with it.
Okay. Now, if so happens that the patients tell you that, right? And funny enough, we all know that that's the veins, right? They feel heavy and then you move. But if a patient tells you this is all the time, what could you do right then as a primary? Should you refer right away to you, or there's something you should do before referring to you?
I would really talk with them about exercise, because moving the legs helps that calf muscle to pump. And that, so if they're sedentary, you know, the biggest thing they can do, and they're going to be told by any vascular specialist, is you got to get walking and have a walking program if they can. And not everybody's able to do that.
Sure.
But yeah, activity is huge. And leg elevation, you know, when they're, it's a balance between when they're able to get moving around to get those legs, that calf muscle pumping. But if they're sitting around, then trying to get the legs above the level of the heart is important.
Yeah. And you could halt the progression right there, perhaps, or minimize.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Weight loss is another huge thing. So if they can get their weight under control and get some of that pressure off of the lower extremities, that's going to make a big difference.
Now, you said calf symptoms, exercises to help the calf squeeze the vessels and pump the blood up. What is that? Walking, just moving the foot up and down? Any particular recommendation for that?
Walking is best. If they can walk, that is the best. If they can't walk, then we talk to them about doing the muscle pumps just by pumping their foot. And if they aren't able to walk, they need to be doing that frequently, every hour, 10 pumps every hour, you know, and that can be hard. People don't want to hear that. And it can be a hard habit to get into.
Okay. Now, I see from time to time people, typically for fasciolaritis, in which I'll see very early brownish discoloration. But is there, not much edema really, is there a stage in which you have like erythema before you have brownish discoloration, or that happens pretty quickly?
Yeah, I mean, often we'll see where they'll get that bilateral redness. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's unilateral, and it doesn't really look brown yet. If it's earlier on, I think it's more pink in color. Okay. And so that does happen very, very early, I would say, on a lot of people, especially with obesity. Yeah.
Is that the stage in which they should be referred to you already?
No, because there's probably not a lot we can do for them here. I would say the big thing at that point is to just get them on a walking program and then talking with them about just some standard compression therapy. If they can get compression stockings on their legs, especially for those people who are sedentary or standing in one place for a long period of time at mm-hmm. their work, that can be really helpful to gradate that pressure in the ankle and help to keep those veins functioning better.
Okay, so let's move on to, at what stage would you say they should be referred to us? What happens next that triggers that point for referral to you?
For a referral to wound care, you know, they've got an ulcer. That ulcer is not healing. It's been persistent, painful, and draining. We do like to see them early on if you're not getting it to heal after a week or two, so that we can kind of get it turned around.
Okay, so just to be clear, let me push more on this. So somebody has a really, clear brownish discoloration, chronic edema, but they don't have any ulcers. No role for them to see you yet then?
That I think can be managed, by primary medicine. We certainly can see them. We're going to have that talk about ambulation, weight loss, and then compression therapy. That probably could be done right in the office setting with the provider. And I don't know that would necessarily need a referral to wound care.
Okay. So one question first for diagnosis. At what point is an ultrasound needed?
So if they're very symptomatic and they've been doing the walking, they're elevating their legs, they've, tried to lose weight and either are being successful or sometimes not successful with that. And just symptoms alone, you should consider getting a venous competency exam. In wound care, we usually do it after standard of care fails. So we're trying debridement and we're trying compression and we're not really getting anywhere. Then we'll proceed pretty early on with a venous competency.
And that's the way you order, or is a Doppler, venous Doppler, or
not a venous Doppler? That won't tell us much. So that only really tells us about blood clots. We want a venous competency because that's going to really look at the backflow in the veins.
Okay, so how is that read? What do you typically get? How is that graded, the result?
They will look at the pressure on the veins. They will take measurements of those veins so that they they'll give us a centimeter range. And so that will tell you what the tortuousness of the vein is.
Okay.
And if there can be something done about it.
Surgically, you mean?
Correct.
Okay. So it's to determine if whether surgery is needed.
Correct. Yes. The venous competency, you can do all the other things and you don't need a venous competency ultrasound. But if you're thinking that they need more interventions to help get these things to heal besides wound care, that's when you're doing that vein comp.
And then what kind of surgery will we be talking about?
It depends on what is going on. Sometimes they can do like a scleral therapy where they inject the veins to basically make them not function. And then the circulation bypasses around that area.
Okay.
They get compensatory veins. Sometimes they'll use radio frequency ablation to obliterate it. And so it really depends on what is going on there. I usually refer off to vascular to make that decision. So the vascular specialist at that point, once you get a venous competency exam, and if it's showing incompetence of the greater saphenous or the lesser saphenous vein or perforator veins that are directly around an area of an ulceration, then I will refer off to vascular to have them decide what level of surgery needs to occur.
Okay. And So we won't probe further into that because that will be a discussion with the vascular surgeon. So let's go back with you then. So, or what you will handle. So you have your patient, chronic discoloration, chronic symptoms, and ulcer. What do you do? What are your typical steps?
So first of all, like we talked about, talking with them about weight loss, talking mm-hmm. with them about walking, the basic things that they can do themselves to try to help things to heal. The next thing that we will do is take a look at the ulcer and decide, does this need debridement or not? Sometimes they're pretty superficial and red-based. They look healthy. They don't need debridement. Other times they're slough covered or they have biofilm over the surface that you can visually see. Debridement is huge for these because it knocks down that topical biofilm and helps encourage the body to heal.
Yeah. And as an infection doctor.
I reiterate,
don't give antibiotics to that. They just, you can scrape it all off and that's all.
Yeah. If you can get that topical biofilm down from that surface, they don't need antibiotics.
Okay. And then compression.
Compression is huge. Yes. Okay. And so you do have to be a little bit careful with compression because sometimes you can get patients who have mixed vascular disease where they have some arterial issues as well. You got to be careful with compression. So I always say before deciding to use compression, make sure that their blood flow is good. You want to make sure that those large arteries are working well in the foot because you can compromise circulation otherwise. So that's the one caveat. But as long as the circulation is good, then compress.
Okay. And because what you're trying to avoid is more deposition of the blood and stagnation and chronic inflammation, etc., right?
Correct. Yes. You're supporting those leaky veins so that you're not getting that swelling and congestion to the tissues, which causes edema and more redness and can look like cellulitis and it can even get really angry looking. But if you can get pressure against those veins, that redness will subside.
Okay. Now, separately, we have a podcast on lymphedema in which we talked about pumps. Is there a role for pumps or you don't want that active?
You can use pumps. And actually, if patients are working with lymphedema management, we will wrap them in a multi-layer wrap because that protects the ulcer and also helps to manage drainage and just keep that localized swelling down. But I will tell those patients to use their pumps as well.
Okay. Now, is there a role for compression if there's no edema? Somebody has ulcers but no major edema?
There is. If you're trying to manage drainage, sometimes the wraps are really effective at that. So venous ulcers can be really have very high exudate. And so the wraps can be really helpful at just exudate management. So we'll use it for that. It's not sometimes necessarily just for compression, but for exudate management.
Okay. Now, of course, I see these patients when they have recurrent cellulitis, horribly recalcitrating wounds. So I don't see your day-to-day success history. So let's say you have somebody with venostasis, brownish discoloration, wounds, but they say, you know, I listen to you, they lose some weight, they try and ambulate, they get the compression, the wound care, etc. What is the ballpark successful rate? And by that, I mean the wounds get healed, they stay healed, and then the patient doesn't progress any further for at least a few years or for the time you're seeing them.
If they're doing all those things, their recurrence rate is pretty low. Of course, compliance is the huge factor.
Of course.
And getting them to comply with wearing compression stockings or compression garments can be very difficult. If they're not doing those things, then their recurrence rate is, we see them over and over and over again. So
what is your real life thing? If you could tell me, well, 1 out of 10, that's good. The others not. What do you see in real life?
Let me think about that. I guess I would say if they're doing everything, we don't see them back for many years. If they are not wearing their compression, sometimes we're seeing them back in the next week because they have significant venous disease. And if they are having a lot of problems, you know, their wounds heal great. We've done all the things. We take them out of their compression. They're not wearing it and they're not keeping stockings on that are meant to be used at home without having to come into the clinic. Then I would consider doing a venous competency ultrasound to see if anything surgically can be done to help them. But I wouldn't do that unless they're not able to manage that with the standard things, such as compression stockings.
And I don't want to dwell much in what you do with wound care because that's a whole world and you do what you do in the clinic. But anything else that you would say for general management for the primary providers before the patients get sent to you?
I think we've covered it as far as, you know, what they can do in the clinic. I know like you said, wound care is difficult because in primary, they have only what they have. And so using the dressings that they have there to start with can be helpful for ulcer management. But the big key is making sure that they're, you know, complying with compression. Compression is really the mainstay of keeping these people healed.
Okay. And visits and equipment, dressings, all that is generally well covered by, you know, insurance or Medicare, et cetera.
Yes, Medicare is really picky about compression. They will only cover compression if there is an active ulcer. So they will not cover an compression like stockings or garments if they don't have an ulcer. It's very backwards. Private insurers are a little bit better about it, but Medicare specifically, they need to have an ulcer to get payment on those.
I'm not into prevention, let's say.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Well, Angie, always a pleasure talking with you. I know you know your stuff, and I'm going to tell a quick anecdote. A few years ago, you probably don't remember, I was telling a patient or a couple, to let your wound air dry, to see what happens, etc. And I really like it that you sent me an email and said, stop contradicting my patients, that's no, and this is the data, and you just shush me, and I appreciate that.
So. Well, I appreciate your knowledge too, Dr. Vinces.
I didn't know what I was talking about on that, so I like it that you were straight to the point. Listen, this is the data. Stop telling them that.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I mean, that is a very common conception that we want to dry things out. But if you can keep them wounds a little bit moist, not let them scab over, they do heal better.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.